This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
And surpass penetrating and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Morning, everyone. I want to welcome you to this warm day at Jikoji, our first warm Sunday in a long time. And to this talk with Ben Connolly, who's here from Minneapolis, Minnesota, where a couple of us here have practiced with Minnesota Zen Meditation Center. Prior to becoming a priest, Ben was a rock and roll star or a singer.
We'll call it a singer.
And came to this practice. And somehow, when he began his practice, you discovered Vasubandhu, and he took the verses, like the 30 verses of Vasubandhu and this one on the three natures. And it's in the Yogacara tradition, and it's crucial to the scholarship of Buddhism, but it's kind of obscure. And this guy knows how to make it real so that it can penetrate our lives. And so enjoy. Thank you, Ben, for being here.
Thank you, Doug. Yeah, so grateful to be with you. You know, I've been here for a couple days with a few of you sitting in a meditation intensive retreat, which has been very lovely. And then it was wonderful to feel the energy of more community coming in for the morning. So I'm looking forward to having the time with you. And this place is, there's something about just coming to this particular land where the space and the land is cared for in a beautiful, careful way, that we can just let it in. The place will do the practice for you if you let it. You don't have to like get some special kind of mind. If you just look at this valley, you look at the way the rocks are arranged, they'll show you a beautiful way that the world can be and that you can carry back home when you leave. So anyway, I'm going to focus my talk today on Vasubandhu's three natures, and I know you're all excited because everyone gets up in the morning and thinks, Vasubandhu's three natures, that's for me. I am aware that this is, for many people, pretty obscure. The material I will be teaching from today is generally not understood as beginner's material, so I think there are some people who are very new here. So if you find some things kind of confusing or really challenging, I just invite you to kind of let it flow by. I'll try and say some things that are helpful. And for those of you who've been hearing me give 4 or 5 Dharma talks about this already in the last 2 days, you may hear some repetition because I have to kind of introduce material to people. So I just invite us all to sort of realize that we're all different in where our understanding and our interests are, and that I'll try and make a talk that hopefully can be resonant in places for each of you in its own way. Mm-hmm. So Vasubandhu was a 4th or 5th century Indian Buddhist monk who was enormously influential on the Buddhist tradition. So he made a large body of writings, which have been basic study texts in most Buddhist monastic traditions in both East Asia and Tibet for over 1500 years, since the time of his life. And Vasubandhu is in all Zen and Chan lineages. So at this temple, if we chant the lineage of ancestors, we'll chant his name as one of the people who brought us the practice that we have today. He's considered one of the 6 ornaments of Tibetan Buddhism and one of the 5 great ancestors of the Jodo Shinshu tradition. And so you may be like, oh, cool. But you may be like, I don't know anything about that. But anyone interested in Buddhism has had their life touched by Vasubandhu, because the ideas that he helped to promote and the practices and ways of looking at the world that he tried to make have permeated the culture, practice, and understanding of Buddhism all over the world. So one of the things I like to do is go to the text and see the really complicated thing he's saying, and then show you how, oh, this is like, that's why at the end of the meal, we chant this. Because when we have formal meals, we'll all chant together. So anyway, that's probably enough just like sort of historical information. The material I'll be teaching today comes from Vasubandhu's work in a movement that's called Yogacara, which means yoga practice, which is about integrating early Buddhist psychology with the Mahayana Buddhist emphasis on collective and universal liberation. So in simple terms, this is about being able to be well, to be happy, to take care of who you are while you're engaging in the world of creating something better and more beautiful for everyone. Or another way to put it is, how to work in the world and not get totally burned out. That's what these teachings are for, because there's teachings to promote a bodhisattva life. What's a bodhisattva? It's a being that constantly shows up for people who are suffering and never gets tired of it. It just says, I'm going to do this for as long as is conceivable. I will not leave you behind. And that's an ideal in this tradition, but it's also a capacity that you have to develop. You can do that. We all can. I believe it. So one of the main reasons I teach a lot of Yogacara is Yogacara forms the philosophical underpinning of Thich Nhat Hanh's movement of engaged Buddhism. So Thich Nhat Hanh is a very influential Vietnamese monk who recently died. And he was really interested in showing how Buddhism gives us tools for not only being well, but for transforming the cultures we're in so other people can be well. And he looked through many Buddhist traditions and saw that Yogacara provided some of the best understanding and tools for doing that work, and then spent many years promoting it. So for me, because Thich Nhat Hanh's teachings transformed my life, one of the main reasons I teach Yogacara and Vasubandhu is to carry forward the beauty and power of the vision of Thich Nhat Hanh. And his books on Yogacara, in particular, his book, Understanding Our Mind, is wonderful, and is similar to this book. It's commentary on Vasubandhu's texts. So the part of Yogacara I'm going to talk about today is called the Three Natures, which is one of the main teachings in the Yogacara tradition. And how to put this? Okay, the Three Natures teaching say, it is beneficial to view each thing as having three natures, which I will be talking about for a while. So, or another way to put it is, it's beneficial to see everything as having these three natures or being of these three natures. Or another way to put it would be, it's beneficial to see any particular thing as having these three characteristics. So natures and characteristics get interchangeably used in this context. So you look at something and you go, I'll think about it in these three ways. And the claim is that will help you. We'll find out if you think that's true by the end of this talk. And if not, you can do something else. It's okay. I'm just talking. So the three natures are the imaginary, the dependent, and the complete realized natures. The imaginary nature, the dependent nature, and the complete realized nature. The imaginary nature of things is what you think they are. The dependent nature is that they appear the way they do, dependent on other things. And the complete realized nature is that they are not what you think they are. Pretty simple. Also terrifyingly challenging. This teaching, if you even got an inkling of what it's pointing to, is really challenging, because I want to believe I know the ultimate truth, or things that I believe are absolute truths. And this says that's never true. So that's challenging. And you might think, is that a good idea? And I will try and lay out the reasoning for why I'm going to claim this is a really good idea. It can really help you to be happier and promote other people's welfare. So I'll say repeatedly throughout this talk, the claim that things are imaginary and not what you think they are does not mean they don't matter or that you're making them up. They matter because they seem real to us. And they're not made up by you. They're made up by the process of the universe. Anyway, I'm going to read you a little passage from this book that I wrote. I wrote a book called, very creative title, Vasubandhu's Three Natures. My working title was Imagination, Interdependence, and Liberation. But if you get to publish any books, you may find out that the publisher usually decides the title. Thank you, publishers. It's a good title. Anyway, this book is a new translation of Vasubandhu's Treatise on Three Natures, which I did with my translation partner, Weijen Teng, who is a professor at Dharmadrum University in Taiwan. And the verses are very short. It's 38 short verses in Sanskrit. So the book is mostly commentary that I have written. So each chapter, there's a verse, and then there's about 1,000 words of commentary. So anyway, I'm going to read you just a little bit from the introduction to start to enter into what these teachings are about. Every aspect of what we would conventionally call experience is of these three natures. All sights, sounds, smells, tastes, physical sensations, thoughts, emotions, and our sense of being as self. For example, the cobalt blue car that I can see outside my window is of an imaginary nature. Whatever I am experiencing it to be right now, a memory, as I'm currently looking at letters on a screen, or now, as I turn my head to look at it again, whatever I think it to be is a construction of habits of consciousness and imagination. I suspect it will take some time for you to consider this a reasonable or useful claim. And so, dear reader, that's why I'm writing this book. That car is also of a dependent nature. Countless conditions that are not the car create the appearance of a car. Reflected sunlight, ocular nerves, supply chain software, oil refineries, the desire for wealth, and so on. This car is also of complete realized nature. It isn't what I think it is. Recognizing that things aren't what you think they are can radically disarm the patterns of your mind that cause you to suffer and cause suffering. For example, in order to see the car in my normal way, I am usually ignorant of or ignore a vast array of conditions on which the appearance of the car depends, conditions that cause suffering in this time of climate crisis. These teachings are to help us move beyond this kind of ignorance. The so-called knowledge that white people are inherently superior to black people, and the purported fact that race exists as a biological phenomenon, were confirmed by 19th century scientific experiments, which have since been disproven. This caused and causes incalculable harm. This so-called knowledge is imaginary. It arises from conditions, and its complete realized nature is that it is not real. And yet millions of people thought and still think it is true. Although many of us do not, the impacts of the view are pervasive. It affects where people live, the jobs we have, the wealth we inherit, our access to education, and so much more. They are alive in how I experience the world. This teaching is here so we may continually grow in our capacity to end and transform harmful patterns of which we are often unaware. By learning to see the three natures of the ideas that maintain harmful systems, we open the way for liberation. The three natures can be misapplied and easily misunderstood. Understanding the imaginary nature invites humility, not grandiosity. It affirms agency. It does not deny experiences. Understanding the dependent nature affirms kinship with all things. It does not deny differences or boundaries. Understanding the complete realized nature brings faith, compassion, and joy. It does not deny suffering. The three natures provide medicine for our ongoing daily sufferings, no matter how small. So to be clear, in both the examples I gave, the object that is analyzed with the three natures is imaginary. The car is imaginary, but the impacts that it has on people's lives are real and usually way beyond what we think they are. In the terms of like climate change is the example I use there, or with race, which is just a social construct that is fairly recent, maybe 400 or 500 years old, even though it's not real, and you can just go, it's not real. It doesn't work very well to just pretend that it doesn't matter. Because if you drive through any city in the United States, you can see the impacts of race very, very clearly just by where people live and how much money there is in the neighborhoods. So this is the basic analysis that gives us to look at things, see they're imaginary, but realize that they have impact and that we are usually looking at them. Our mind frames things. It says there are objects that are not me, which is the first delusion, not an absolutely true thing. It's just a weird habit of mind. Maybe you're not experiencing it right now. Good job. But anyway, we have this weird habit of mind to think that there's a subject that views objects. And then a more extensive process of objectification that turns the world into things from the lens of our feelings about them and what we think will work for us. So we see things from the lens of like, do we like them or not? And then feelings of desire and aversion arise, and then we act from that, and then we produce systems, many of which don't really work for us. We human beings are wonderful and awesome, but we also hurt each other and we suffer. And we try and get things we can't get. We try and hold on things we can't hold on to. So all that is dependent on a system where it appears there are things that are absolutely real objects. That turning of them into things is something the mind does. It's not something that's absolutely true. Because they're of complete realized nature. They're not what you think they are. So I'm going to start to work through the three natures one at a time. So to kind of talk about their particular implications. So with the imaginary nature, one of the well-known in Buddhism, you'll often hear, they'll say, you should view things as an illusion or a magic show or a dream. It's very common in all types of Buddhism. And that's usually a medicine because it is possible sometimes to just put down something that's making you really unhappy and go, I don't have to do this. I don't have to do this process. You know, you've probably had an experience where you're really upset about something and 2 weeks later, you're like, what was the big deal? That's you seeing that your mind made all that suffering. And it's possible with practice to start to be able to do that much quicker. So you're about to have an argument. You've had the same argument with your family member 15 times, 500 times, and it's about to start. You just go, I'm not doing this. I don't have to do this. That's just made up. So that's a common pervasive Buddhist medicine around the idea of things are illusory. But Yogacara teachings use the idea that things are imaginary in a distinctive and really almost opposite way, because they say, because things are imaginary, you have power. Because the world is being created by a process of imagination, what you do in every moment plants the seeds that will create the world that you and other people live in. So the basic logic here is that any action with the body or with the mind, any type of thinking or any emotion plants a seed that will produce a similar fruit at a later date. So actions of body, speech, and mind plant seeds which produce similar fruit, which some of you may recognize as just being karma. But karma theory in Yogacara is not identical to all other karma theories. There are lots of different ways to understand karma. Anyway, so in this moment, it seems like this to me, all this stuff, this is made up by previous seeds. So at some point early in life, I started to have the idea that there was a me that was separate from the world that needed to get things. And so that became a very pervasive view that I experienced. And then it was like, oh, people are really interesting because like I had people who took care of me. So that's interesting. So then my mind automatically really wants to check out the people in the room. My mind is way more focused on you than it is on the ceiling. And I'll bet yours is too, because we planted seeds of caring about people. And then, you know, there's all kinds of preconceptions and ideas I have about people. I'm like, if someone looks like this, I'll be like, I don't think they're that into the talk. Whereas if someone's like this, I'm like, ooh, what's going on? All that I had to have all these seeds of interpreting facial expressions to make what seems like this absolutely real moment seem real. And I'm just talking about facial expressions right now. Every element of how this moment is experienced is constructed by thousands, if not millions, of seeds bearing fruit in the moment of previous ways of thinking about what an experience is. Wow. So in Yogacara texts, we call this is like a river flowing or like a waterfall. So the idea is you can't just like pick it out and be like, oh, I got that. It's like there's so much happening. So, you know, there's all this conditioning from the past, cultural conditioning, familial conditioning, personal conditioning that plant seeds. And then here we are. Here's the main reason for all this teaching. In this moment, you are always planting seeds, and those seeds will always bear fruit. There is no moment in the life of any sentient being where they're not doing something that is either conducive to well-being, to harm, or something neutral. What you do always matters, because you're creating how we will imagine the world. You'll create the way we perceive things. So this is why in Zen temples, it's like, you know, just last night, I was like, oh, I'm brushing my teeth for the liberation of all beings to clear away all delusion. You know, I was taught to say that little verse when I brush my teeth to remind myself, it's not dead time. This is a moment that matters. When you're like, oh yeah, bow at the cushion, bow to the other place. You're like, oh, it's all the bows. It's to try and remind us that your life matters. Would you like to live a life where you see everything with reverence and care and appreciation? You can plant those seeds in a zendo. And here's the thing with karma theory. This is consistent across most Buddhist traditions. When a karmic seed is planted, you never know when it will manifest. It could manifest in 1 second. It could manifest in 10 weeks, in 10 years, in 1,000 years, in several thousand years. And this is one of the geniuses of the system, because if this wasn't there, it really wouldn't make sense, because you see people who are doing terrible things over and over again, and they're just like reaping the wealth. They look pretty happy. You're like, why is that? They're still planting seeds. Does the impact, will the impact of their actions show up in the world? I think so. And this really helps to have this time frame as well. If you really give yourself to something, trying to be well, trying to do the liberative practice of Buddhism, trying to find housing for the people who are living on the street in your neighborhood, trying to feed the people who are starving in a country with wealth that is almost unimaginable, to be able to keep going. I know people have been working on that for 50 years, and we still walk down the street and see people hungry and unhoused. You can plant seeds. This is about a way of looking at the world where you never give up. And you never feel like you need to, because there's no objects to control, because everything isn't really what you think it is. It's the quality of your intention that you bring to the moment that is transformative, not the apparent external object that you think you manipulated. So you may be like, yeah, cool. You might be like, this is so out there. Well, cool. You know, we're just doing something here. So everything is of an imaginary nature. We collectively create the imagination that is experienced by people. People have created what we have. Think of all the seeds that had to be planted for us to be here. What a trip. And then because things are of dependent nature, everything is collective. So there's no actual situation in which anything is not entirely connected to everything else. So in Yogacara texts, and this is like a pervasive Buddhist view, but it's understood particularly in Yogacara. One of the basic techniques in Yogacara is to conceptualize interdependence. And if you've ever read Thich Nhat Hanh, this is one of his favorite things. You just think about how one thing depends on another. So you just go, well, look at this. I'm just going to start with, how did it get green? The greenness of this book. How did that happen? Well, there had to be some dye, and there was probably some complex chemical process and people who ran a dye plant. And those people had whole lives that are here in this book, without which this book would not be green. And for them to be there, there had to be food and there had to be love and care in the child rearing that, you know, people don't live past one without some love and care. Just can't happen. If you've ever had a baby, you know that already. Wow, that's in here. I didn't even get started. We could pass this book around for the rest of our lives, saying things on which just the green color of this book depends, and never run out. There's five colors on here. How long do you want to go? Wow. And a lot of people think, okay, that's cool. I heard Thich Nhat Hanh do that 10 times. I'm set. This is a practice. It's a practice to look at things and see their dependence and see, instead of just seeing them through our conditioned lens and opening up to how completely each thing is part of the whole. So it's very common for people to begin to know the dependent nature of things very intuitively if they make a commitment to Zazen, to the very simple style of meditation that we do in Soto Zen, which involves very little figuring anything out or trying to make anything happen. And it's really just resting in the wholeness of this moment, the completeness of the sounds and the sights and the bodily sensations and whatever thoughts arise and the feelings. And just opening your hands and letting it all be there. Caring about it enough to be there with it. And when we do this, the part of the mind that's always dividing things up to try and figure things out gets a little quiet, and we plant some seeds of spaciousness. And what's very common for people to feel much more connected. And someone will come to our Zen center and say, yeah, I never tried this meditation. I came by a few mornings and then I went home and I had to get the kids to school. And instead of just being like, why don't you have your shoes on? Come on, we got to get the thing. Do you have your package for you? I had this moment where I was just like, wow, I'm just here in this room with you and I love you. There's just a pause from the constant utility and productivity that's conditioned into us. And there's just presence and connection and appreciation. And that comes from that sense of openness to the relationship that is there. That's recognizing the dependent nature of things intuitively. So that can feel really good, really, really good. To let go of our alienation and open up to connection is pretty nice. Recognizing the dependent nature can also be quite painful, because it often involves seeing that we are related to things that we don't want to be related to that are harmful. So anybody who's done like a metta meditation practice where you think good thoughts about someone you don't like, that's a medicine specifically designed to take us to this point. To see your well-being is dependent on that person, you're like, ah, it's uncomfortable. But, you know, we can learn to live with that. You know, in the ultimate sense, the implication of the dependent nature of things, that there is no suffering anywhere that has ever happened that you can ever be separate from, which is kind of freaky. But the idea isn't to somehow try and like take that all in and absorb it. But it's worth just kind of acknowledging it. If everything is inseparable, all the good and all the bad is here. And the process of becoming more sensitive to this often involves looking at things where we don't want to look. So it might be you have in your family, there's harm that's been done that no one ever wants to talk about. And you're like, we're never going to realize how intimate we are until we talk about this. And it can be very painful. Or just with your spouse, you're like, is that one thing you're just always shoving under the rug? And it's like, you know, you'd be closer if you acknowledged it. We're scared of the pain sometimes that comes with acknowledging the web of dependencies we're in. There are parts of it we want to push away. And with climate change, it's painful. I say the word climate change and I see bodies sag. Acknowledging it is hard, right? We know, I think probably most of us or all of us are aware we're part of a system that's hugely, monumentally damaging. Wow. And it's hard. You know, we like, can I just not look at that? Because it's really painful. And Joanna Macy is a pioneering Buddhist ecological activist. And she says, you have to start the work by just acknowledging how big the problem is and dealing with the feelings you have about it, which are probably going to be really hard. But the thing is, you can actually do that. This is what I know. I've sat down with groups who do it. And then it's like, you're like, well, I've done some grieving and now I know I care. That's cool. So instead of pretending there's not a problem, you just acknowledge it. You realize you're a part of it. It's not somewhere else. You have some part to play because guess what, friends? It's of an imaginary nature and you're planting seeds. You can't control it. I mean, do you think if we just had a meeting, we'll end climate change? I don't think so. But every one of us is planting seeds on which direction culture is going. The way we consume, the way we think about consumption, the way we advocate in our social spheres, they all have impact. It feels better, my friends, I believe, to face the difficulties and act as an empowered being than pretend that we're powerless and they're separate from you. You may debate that with me, and there may be periods where it really doesn't seem true, but ultimately, I think that's the true story. So I'm going to read a short passage from the book. This is a longer passage related to the dependent nature of phenomena. And I will tell you that Vasu Bandhu gives you the distinct characteristics of the three natures. Each one is different. Bing, he explains that. And then he says, oh, by the way, they're all identical and non-dual, which for those of you who are used to Zen are like, oh yeah, there we go. And the rest of you can find that weird. That's okay. You may, as I read this, you might be like, wait, which one are we talking about? And that's because they are both distinct and completely intertwined because they're of dependent nature. We don't passively receive the reality of the world through our senses and then respond to it. The world we experience is created. It is, as the text says, the active cognition of seer and seen. Our life is created by our karma, and we create karma in every moment. We have the power to plant seeds that will create a better world. This body of teachings emphasizes the impact of each moment of intentionality. Our power lies in the quality of heart and mind we offer to the moment. Why do I think this worldview is more effective than materialism for healing our suffering and freeing us from collective modes of violence, oppression, and destruction? I will answer with some lines from a Chinese Chan nun named Baoqi, who wrote, "The vastness of karmic consciousness is hard to prove, but when Mr. Zhang drinks, then Mr. Li gets drunk." I will mention at this moment that I am an addict and alcoholic who has been in recovery from addiction for about 25 years. Sometimes I get a call or I see an obituary telling me that another friend of mine has died from addiction. I've lost a dozen friends so far, and I can never know what part my enabling of their intoxication played, or the impact their deaths and addictions will have on future generations of their families. The web is too complex to map with materialist tools. I can never know the impact of the thousands of hours I've spent working with addicts in recovery either. I have witnessed the awakening of so much freedom. One of Baoqi's inspirations, the great Chan Nun Miaozong, wrote, "When outside the diamond door he glowered, inside the stable, the wooden horse's face turned red." In the verse above, there is no physical connection between the man's glower and the wooden horse's face. And yet there is reaction and connection. We cannot ultimately know when or where the results of any karmic seed will manifest, but manifest they will. Miaozong wrote her lines in a Chan compilation she created in the 12th century. But could she have known that in the 17th century, Baoqi and her Dharma sister Zukui, looking to revive the rarely recorded teachings of a female master of Chan, would pull them from obscurity and write their own commentaries, or that Beata Grant in the 21st century would again revive them in English translation? I believe that buying a chunk of an animal killed thousands of miles away, or offering a caring smile for a person on the street, as well as each tiny moment of anxiety, desire, or compassion you cultivate has an impact on every living being. I cannot measure it. Miaozong says the wooden horse's face turns red. A wooden horse is a classic Buddhist metaphor for something that has no reality or causal agency, like the horns of a rabbit, a wooden man, or a stone woman. Miaozong invites us into a worldview of mystery where we don't know or see what is ultimately real, but where an angry glare causes suffering we can't calculate, where a smile has radiance beyond the limits of our knowing, where our actions really matter. All of this isn't real, but it's as real as it gets. So everything is of complete realized nature. Good news, everybody. This means you are Buddha, and this is Nirvana. I'm not kidding. So simply put, what makes a Buddha is they don't suffer, they don't cause suffering, and they see what's real. And those things are all essentially identical, because by seeing what's real, they see that there's no reason to suffer, and they know what to do to promote non-suffering. So this teaching is saying they are seeing the complete realized nature. That's the definition of the complete realized nature, what Buddhas see. They see that what appear to be real absolute objects are not. They're not. And they don't deny it. They don't just say, never mind, your problem doesn't matter. They realize it seems real to you, so they hang out with you and try and help you be well. They say the first step is to help make sure people have food and shelter and medicine. And if they have those things, teach them the Dharma consistently. So, complete realized nature. So the term Parinibbana Svabhava means like everything is whole, it's unbroken, this dividedness that our mind makes it look like it has, where there's you and me and, you know, walls and ceilings, time, moments that are separate from the past. Just because our consciousness happens to perceive in moments, does that make them real? That's a ridiculous claim. Why are we so self-centered? It's so weird. Anyway, so not that I don't think moments are very real. So yeah, things are of complete realized nature. And this is often taught, Vasubandhu teaches this way, and then we'll see many other people who do this, will refer to the complete realized nature of this body, your body, anybody, and the complete realized nature of our environment. So Vasubandhu, in the last verse of his 30 verses on consciousness only, which is the subject of one of my books, he says, this is the inconceivable, wholesome, unstained, constant realm, the blissful body of liberation, the Dharma body of the great sage. And I say, I'm saying it and I'm waving my hands around, but the point is you can chant the text, you ought to, according to Vasubandhu, and you can be like, this is the inconceivable, wholesome, unstained, constant realm, the blissful body of liberation, the Dharma body of the great sage, because it's not what you think it is. All the things in it that suffer aren't absolutely real. They can be put down. So this doesn't deny, if they seem real, that we should take care of them. So the complete realized nature does not deny the imaginary nature. These three are employed together. We look at all things as having all three characteristics. So Hakuin paraphrases Vasubandhu in the last lines of his Song of Zazen, where he says, this very place is the lotus land, this very body the Buddha. This very place along with the very body of the Buddha. Dogen Zenji, who founded Soto Zen, or a Soto Zen temple, his essentially when he came to Japan and said, I'm founding a school, he wrote the Fukan Zazengi, which is the universal recommendation for Zazen. It's the foundational text of the tradition. And it says why and how to practice Zazen. And it starts like this: the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. How could it depend on practice and realization? The true vehicle is self-sufficient. What need is there for special effort? Indeed, the whole body is free from dust. Who could believe in a means to brush it clean? It is never apart from this very place. What is the use of traveling around to practice? All three teachers say the same thing. This body, you are of complete realized nature. You are Buddha. You have Buddha nature and you are Buddha nature. And this place is where Buddhas live. And if you think that's weird, when Buddha attained nirvana, what happened? He just looked like a regular person hanging out with people, doing people stuff. That's the record we have. You don't go somewhere else, to some other special place. It's a way of seeing what is here. So I'm going to read you two short passages related to the idea that things are of complete realized nature. One is about the complete realized nature of you, and the other will be about the complete realized nature of where you are. And these are shorter than the previous readings. And we'll conclude my talk. This is from a chapter called Already Buddha. When I came to Buddhist practice, I was seeking something else. I sought an escape from the anguish I experienced. My therapists told me it was the anguish of trauma from the past reproducing itself. My psychiatrist told me my brain didn't process serotonin properly. My addiction recovery friends called it defects of character, self-will run riot. My Buddhist studies called it afflictive karma. All these ways of looking at it have their utility, and I am deeply grateful for all who have supported me in finding the wondrous, joyful existence of today. When we suffer, when we see the suffering of others, it is right to seek wellness, to seek something else. However, it is also true that there is not something else, that you and I are not and cannot be broken. For if there is brokenness, there must be a wholeness that is elsewhere. This is a duality, and duality is just a habit of mind. And on the subject of where we're at. Recently, I heard a talk by a Dakota elder named Bob Klanderud. He spoke of the total kinship of all life. He told us that the confluence of the Mississippi and Minnesota rivers near my home on U.S.-occupied Dakota land is called Bedote. For the Dakota, Bedote is the origin of the universe. The land. In his words, it is Eden. He asked us, now that you know you live in Eden, how will you choose to live? All right. Well, thank you for your kind attention. And now is the time for other voices. I welcome folks to ask questions or make brief reflections. And questions, it can be a little daunting, I think, for some people. So the range of kind of questions might be something like, what do you see the commonality between Dogen's vision of rocks, tiles, walls, and rubble being made of mind with early Buddha, early Yogacara, and then later Chinese Yogacara? So if you like that kind of question, that's okay. And if your question is kind of like, I can't get my kids to get out of bed in the morning, what should I do? That's okay too. So really, yeah, what's meaningful to you? Yeah, and it would be lovely to hear your voice. Yeah.
Thank you for your talk, Ken. Very moved, actually. But what I wanted to bring up is Carlo Rovelli. Everyone here who knows me knows I have a complete crush on this scientist. He's a quantum theorist in the relational field of quantum gravity. And if you would say those three natures, I will respond with something that I'd like to share. I can't remember them properly, so you could help me out. But I think it's very interesting because it's totally Yogacara. That he comes from, but he might not know it. But what was the first one?
Imaginary,
Imaginary is how we see the world when we have constructs like atoms, atoms being little balls, anything like that, that the earth is flat and that science is constantly revising these things, knowing that they're imaginary. What's the next one?
Dependent.
Dependent. There are no objects. What we know now from quantum theory and mechanics is that everything is an interaction. Nothing is real unless it's manifesting in interaction. And this is the science. Doesn't it sound like Buddhism?
It does.
What was the other one?
The complete realized nature.
The complete realized nature we will never know in science. We only have those two things, but we must be aware that they are not complete realized nature and that we are always, always revising the science with which we understand the world.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah. And there is material in here on the interaction between Yogacara theory and contemporary physics. Not a lot, but yeah, that really rings true. And the distinction is that Yogacara is fundamentally an ethics. So it starts from the perspective of what worldview would create liberation from suffering. Interestingly, it ends up with a lot of similar views that physics did, which I'm sure many people have, you know, an ethical aspiration in their work on physics, but it's not the essential underpinning that drives the work. And it is interesting, though, that they have a lot in common. So thank you very much for that. Yeah. Klaus.
Thanks, Ben, for your talk and for your time here. Since I know you for the last 3 days and Doug mentioned you're a rock star, so the question I had first was, could you sing a song for us? And maybe refrain from it and stay on the topic. And I know you have humor, so you take it and you mentioned these two type of questions, right? And I had exactly the opposite question in mind, what was just asked, right? So I thought it fits well and I asked it on the other extreme. So imagine the scenarios that you have a family member, could be your kids, your wife, or relative, or work colleague, right? Who is just super annoying, and not just once, right? On a daily basis, maybe not daily, but quite frequently. Mm-hmm. And it affects you, it affects people around you. So how do you apply the three natures to it?
Just slapping. Nope. No.
Really. Your advice, be
there. Really. So for me, when there's someone that I find really annoying, there are things I can do. One is to, in all of us, this is the first movement that these teachings, I'm emphasizing a particular part of Yogacara, but within the theory of the imaginary, then the idea is since we imagine in a particular way, we want to start to look at the world in a way that helps. And that starts by knowing the body and knowing the emotion that's present. And I cannot recommend enough, I think it is actually impossible that you will spend too much energy developing awareness of your body and your emotions. And so in that moment, that shift makes a big difference because instead of you're annoying, I'm like, oh, there's annoyance here. First, it might be like, I'm annoyed. And then I can start to be like, oh, there's, you know, there's tension in my body. I feel annoyance. That changes. I've removed the absolute object of an annoying person and started to explore the process of my consciousness that constructs an annoying person. So then the next step might be, then it's like, well, what would be helpful here? Now, telling someone they're annoying is rarely helpful. But it is possible to say, you know, when you said that thing to me, I felt hurt or I felt frustrated. So bringing it down to particular moments, and this is not so much Yogacara, but basic Buddhist ethics, right? Speech. We address people when they do harmful things, but we don't turn them into an object that has a permanent characteristic. So then there may be opportunity for conversation. And then the other thing at some point is to realize they're a complete realized nature. They're not an object that's controllable. Nothing is. So the beauty of this is the emphasis comes on how am I relating to this instead of how do I make something happen out there? And that's a position of empowerment and it will develop connection because people don't feel like they're viewed as objects. So those are a few ideas. It's a rich topic, though. So thank you very much. Yeah, go ahead.
First, thank you for your previous book, The Vasubandhu's 30 Verses on Consciousness. I think it came a few years ago and I got your book and I read it. And I've read it a few times, like just the verses, and it's really great. So thanks for translating that.
Can everyone hear? No. Oh, could you just invite you to?
So Ben came maybe 5 years ago or less, and he shared his book on the 30 verses of consciousness. And I've read the book once and the 30 verses many times, and it's really wonderful. So just wanted to thank Ben for taking the time to write that. And also thanks for sharing your vulnerabilities. I appreciate that very much, that you're so open about all of your challenges. My next question was about this particular book on the three natures. So as you explained, there's the three natures, which is imaginary and interdependent and the complete realized nature. And could you pick a verse, or is it the case that Vasubandhu points to anything within the verses that like takes a person from, let's say, the second nature to the third nature? Like, is there any verse that points to that, if you could read that? There
is. Yeah. I don't know if there is a verse that really does that. One thing is that, you know, in the 30 verses, he says, if the dependent nature is not seen, then the complete realized nature is not seen. So actually seeing them is in some sense identical. But there is, there's like a little thing on progression. I'll read this. I'll read this. This may not be for everyone. These verses are really challenging, but I'm just going to read it at your request, and I'll probably leave it at that and not dig into it too much. But so he basically says everything is already of these three natures, but it's conventional in Buddhist teaching to talk people through seeing one, then the other, because people seem to have a developmental mindset. So he says, for the purpose of growth in understanding, these natures are often understood in stages from the point of view of conventions and insight into them. The imagined is conventional existence. The dependent is the maker of conventional existence. And the third nature is the cutting off of conventions. First, one understands the dependent, a dual non-existence. Then one understands the merely imaginary there, non-existent duality. Then one understands the realized, the existence of the non-existence of duality. For then it is just thus. It is said to be and not to be. So that may take some unpacking. That's why I wrote the book. But at the end, it's just thus. It's like this. It's not this. It's like this. You see this all the time in Chinese literature. Two characters, like this. Like this. I'm not saying it is this. That sounds like something I can get. Like this. Anyway, just playing around. Thank you for the question. And I'll see if anyone else wants to raise anything up here. Any kind of questions are welcome. Or, yeah, responses. Yeah,
something about, like, for the final stage, like, fully realize the form, have you really understand it and feel it? Because once I want to understand it, it may become imaginary, right? So that, because like this, it's not this, right?
That is correct. So it's ungraspable. So later in the text, it says these three natures are ungraspable, non-dual. So that's actually what makes the freedom, is it's like, oh, if there's nothing to hold on to, there's nothing I can be bummed about losing, right? So it's the freedom from your own views that's liberating. So yes, precisely.
What are the methods and practice that you need to do in order to get to the complete nature or complete realized nature?
Yeah. What are the practices? That's a good, let's get there. It sounds pretty good, right? Well, it's already here. So back to Dogen Zenji, the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent on practice and realization? So one thing Dogen says in that, that's the opening of his why to practice Zazen and how. Later on, he says, you should know that the true vehicle appears of itself. So from the very beginning, dullness and distraction are struck aside. So what he's saying is, if you know that you already live in realization, wouldn't you pay attention to it? Be like, wow, this moment is amazing. Like I'm walking from my car to my house. Incredible. There are no unimportant moments. Every moment is completely replete with the entire universe. So that's one approach I can recommend, is just marvel that we can even be here. And sometimes, you know, you might experience some anguish. I've experienced, be like, how can I even be experiencing this anguish that I get to be a part of the world with people and to be able to care about this pain that's here? Amazing. And there's a wholeness. You can see the wholeness that's there. But for the purpose of growth and understanding, these are often understood as stages. So there are many different approaches to practice, I think, that can move you to this place. But I encourage people to immerse themselves in Buddhist community where ethics, meditation, and developing good community are central. And I think if you make that commitment, there's nothing better you can do for moving forward to the possibility of us all being more free. So there's some ideas. Thank you. Yeah, other voices. Who's out there like, I can't say anything?
Me? Yeah. I've been sitting here wanting to say something, but I just I struggle with doing so. I will say this. I want to thank you for the context of what you put forth. I consider myself a living proof of this being a progressive and ongoing experience. Yeah, become a part of this community recently to the point where I do walk to the car 20% of the time, very conscious and mindful of the fact that what a gift I get to walk to the car. You know, what a gift I get to sit here with a bunch of people who are all trying to find a way to be something positive and put something good into the world. I see the nature around us and the trees and the burnt out limbs from a fire that are actually fuel for another generation of growth that's on the horizon. And I think that in essence is what we all are. You know, we are here, we are in this moment, we are having these experiences, even grief. I mean, I told a counselor a couple of years ago, is it weird for me to think that grief is beautiful? Because I get to experience that grief. I get to be a part of this being alive. And so I'm very, very intrigued. I do feel the elusive aspect of gaining that utter awareness. I mean, for lack of a better way of putting it, it's the end of the matrix where all of a sudden Neo sees all of the zeros and the ones and this construct and this entire thing that's happening that he had no idea. This is what's really here. You know, that's a huge aspiration, but it does feel like I'm starting to get little moments of just recognition that there's a lot more going on than we put our time, attention, and gratitude into. So that's what I kind of wanted to say.
Thank you. Thank you for reflecting on your practice.
You called me out.
So I'm going to wrap this talk up like this. It's going to take a minute. So I had the great fortune of traveling to Vietnam with some nuns who are colleagues of mine to visit Vietnamese temples a couple months ago, and it was an amazing and beautiful and humbling experience. And I spent a few days at a, several days at a convent called Vien Chiu in the bamboo forest tradition. There were about 150 nuns there, beautiful practice, amazing place. And they have a really deep singing culture there. I arrived during a full moon ceremony and I just wanted to lie down and weep when I heard the chanting. And they write songs and they sing together. So I gave my Dharma talk, and at the end, one of them got up, sang a song all the way through in English, and then said, "Your turn." The imaginary nature, recognizing it, allows us to be free. Instead of like, oh, it's like this, it's like, oh, it's like what? Creative. So here, we'll sing a song. Call and response. So you may know this song. You're going to learn this song. I'm going to teach this song for people who don't know it. I sing, "I'm going to lay down my sword and shield." And you sing, "Down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. I'm going to lay down my sword and shield. Down by the riverside, down by the riverside." I think you do this. "I'm gonna put on my long brown robe down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. I'm gonna put on my long brown robe down by the riverside, down by the riverside." I'll do one more verse. "I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield." You gotta hear me in Vietnam. "Down by the riverside, down by the riverside." See, do it together. That's how it works. Thank you all. Thank you all. All right, what's next? Oh, do we have a very formal chant now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.